Hey there, fellow travelers. Greta and I are off this week. However, instead of leaving you feeling dead inside from the total absence of my amazing voice, I've decided to give you a special gift this week. The first two chapters of my very first book, Tolkien's Requiem, concerning Beren and Lúthien. By the way, make sure to check out tolkiensrequiem.com for more information on how to get the whole thing. Tolkien's Requiem is available now in signed paperback, standard paperback, Kindle ebook, and audiobook via Audible. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. Chapter 1, The Seed of Middle-Earth. On the shared gravestone of J.R.R. Tolkien and his beloved wife Edith are written two names, Beren and Lúthien. These are no mere pet names, but instead the names of two of Tolkien's Silmarillion characters, a pair of star-crossed lovers who forever changed the fate of Middle-earth by their heroic deeds, and are even recounted in poetic reference in Tolkien's masterwork, The Lord of the Rings. Still, as can be inferred from their placement upon the gravestone, they are very personal names as well. Upon Edith's death in 1971, Tolkien wrote, "In 1909 I met the Lúthien Tenúviel of my own personal romance, with her long dark hair, fair face and starry eyes, and beautiful voice. Now she has gone before Beren, leaving him indeed one-handed, but he has no power to move the inexorable Mandos, and there is no Dorgirth y Quinar, the land of the dead that live, in this fallen kingdom of Arda, where the servants of Morgoth are worshipped." Despondent though the quote is in its spousal anguish, it remains obscure for those unfamiliar with Tolkien's life work, The Silmarillion. Tolkien's reference is, in fact, to the seed story of his sub-created secondary world, the epic poem The Lay of Lúthien, first made known to the general public as a chapter in The Silmarillion entitled Of Beren and Lúthien. Of Beren and Lúthien is the tale of a mortal warrior and immortal princess who transcend the evil wrought by scheming foes and together fulfill a quest to recover a Silmaril, a great and precious jewel, the bride price of Lúthien's hand. It reveals Tolkien's own view of romantic love, of its pinnacle, and of its pitfalls and trade-offs as well. This text will examine the story from the perspective of a poison-love duality, and furthermore will expound upon the role of eucatastrophe in The Silmarillion. I will demonstrate that the love of Beren and Lúthien is the eucatastrophic force that puts right the great wrongs done by previous generations, though at great cost to the heroic pair themselves. In 1939, Tolkien delivered a lecture at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. In this essay, Tolkien, who had recently become famous as a writer of something like fairy tales with the publication and overnight success of The Hobbit, sketched out a literary theory of fantasy narrative and claimed that, when done rightly, it is not a lower but a higher form of art, indeed the most nearly pure form, and so, when achieved, the most potent. At the same time, Tolkien chided more allegorical or symbolical modes of fantasy for leaving little to the interpretation and imagination of the reader, and instead promoted a method he termed subcreation that focuses on creating a reality worthy of secondary belief. The end result of such a work would likely result in something Tolkien identified and coined eucatastrophe, which he also called the true form of fairy tale and its highest function. Tolkien defined eucatastrophe as the consolation of fairy stories, the joy of the happy ending, or more correctly, of the good catastrophe, the sudden joyous turn. He went on to further specify that eucatastrophe is not escapist, in that it does not deny the existence of discatastrophe, of sorrow and failure, but that these are necessary to its power as a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. Thus, eucatastrophe is the happy turn catalyzed by some initial discatastrophe, the redemption after the fall, though mingled still with its own attendant sorrows and injuries. The concept of eucatastrophe, the happy turn, is key to Tolkien's fiction, as anyone who has read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings can probably recognize. A hint. For Tolkien, eucatastrophe often involves eagles. Of Beren and Lúthien takes place in a fallen world, a world that has lost the great light of the two trees of Valinor, Telperion the silver, and Lorelin the gold. The very title, The Silmarillion, comes from the story of the great elf lord Feanor, the fiery spirit, who crafts three unbreakable jewels and fills them with the glorious light of these two trees. His creations are the marvels of all, though they receive such attention that Feanor quickly becomes suspicious of admirers and seeks to hide them away from all except his closest kin, in an effort to protect them. When the Dark Lord Melkor, known in the story of Beren and Lúthien as Morgoth, and the hideous spider demon Ungoliant poison Telperion and Lorelin, the Silmarils are all that remain of their light, and the only hope of restoring them. Nevertheless, Feanor refuses to surrender the Silmarils to the great powers, the Valar, quasi-angelic beings, of Valinor, and when Melkor murders his father and steals the three Silmarils, Feanor and his sons swear an unbreakable oath that none shall ever possess the Silmarils except for them. Feanor and his kin, the Noldor, depart Valinor in anger and pride, murdering their weaker kinsmen and stealing their ships. In sum, centuries of war and sorrow are set off by these three great discatastrophes: the poisoning of the two trees, the theft of the Silmarils, and the kinslaying. These are not the first falls in the long history of Middle-earth, though they are perhaps the most significant for the purposes of the tale of Beren and Lúthien. With these incidents, the action of the Silmarillion shifts from the blessed realm of Valinor, across the sea in the east, to Beleriand in the northwest of Middle-earth. The proper account of Beren and Lúthien takes place many years later, long after Feanor has perished at the hands of Morgoth's forces. Beren emerges as the last survivor of a band of mortal warriors, and, encountering the immortal Lúthien, seeks her hand. The great elf king Thingol, Lúthien's father, requires that Beren obtain Silmaril from Morgoth's crown as Lúthien's bride price, a seemingly impossible task. Yet, through the aid of Lúthien and the mighty wolf beast Huon, they succeed against all odds at finally obtaining a single Silmaril, though at the cost of their lives. Such is often the fate of the heroes in Tolkien's world. Though a victory is achieved, the hero is unable to enjoy its spoils. Beren and Lúthien's story is ultimately a great eucatastrophic light amidst multiple building discatastrophes. Their love serves to counteract the poisonous effects of the numerous discatastrophes that precede it and surround it. Events often driven by a poisoned love, that is, a love that is misdirected or selfish. Before examining the story of Beren and Lúthien proper, it will be helpful to gain a brief understanding of the discatastrophes surrounding the Silmarils themselves, as this will help to illustrate how the stage is set for the eucatastrophe of Beren and Lúthien. The next chapter will present a brief history of the events that lead up to the time of Beren and Lúthien, and set the stage for the events of their story. Chapter 2: Feanor, Melkor, and the Tragedy of the Two Trees. From the beginning, the world, Arda, or Middle-earth, is endlessly lit by the lamps of the Valar. One is situated in the extreme north, the other is situated in the extreme south. Together they create a changeless day. However, Melkor, in a great assault, throws the lamps down and their lights are broken, and the lands of Arda are horribly marred. Yavanna, Valier of Growing Things, and Nienna, Valier of Tears, together create the two trees of Valinor, Telperion and Lorelin. They become the new sources of light for the Western world. What follows is an age of joy, not only for the quasi-angelic beings of Valinor, but also for the elder children of Ilúvatar, the elves, who are drawn to the light from across the great sea. When Manwë, Valinor's king, summons the elves, it is so they might, with his people, enjoy the light of the two trees forever. The two trees of Valinor are contrasting and complementary, and they seem to be typologically oriented to the two races of the children of Ilúvatar. Telperion is the elder. He is silver, and one of his flowers eventually becomes the moon. Lorelin is gold, and one of her fruits eventually becomes the sun. It is the emergence of the sun that awakens men, whereas the elves awoke under starlight, and thus the moon cherishes their memory. Melkor, never content with the destruction he has previously wrought, sets out to destroy the two trees of Valinor with the aid of Ungoliant. Ultimately, his design is not so much the destruction of the two trees as it is the possession of the Silmarils and the ruining of the elves, whom he hates. Tolkien relates the murder of the two trees thusly. There came the mingling of the lights when both trees were shining, and the silent city of Valmar was filled with the radiance of silver and gold. And in that very hour Melkor and Ungoliant came hastening over the fields of Valinor, as the shadow of a black cloud upon the wind fleets over the sunlit earth. And they came before the green mound of Ezelohar. Then the unlight of Ungoliant rose up even to the roots of the trees, and Melkor sprang upon the mound. And with his black spear he smote each tree to its core, wounded them deep, and their sap poured forth as it were their blood, and was spilled upon the ground. But Ungoliant sucked it up, and going then from tree to tree, she set her black beak to their wounds, till they were drained. And the poison of death that was in her went into their tissues and withered them, root, branch, and leaf. And they died. While Ungoliant's poison deals final death to the trees, it is Melkor's hatred of the Valar, hatred motivated by a prideful self-love, which occasions their death. Yet even so, there is a certain lust that factors into Melkor's action as well. His designs reach beyond the destruction of the two trees into a desire for possession. Previous to this episode, Tolkien had attributed to Melkor an intense lust for the Silmarils. Then Melkor lusted for the Silmarils, and the very memory of their radiance was a gnawing fire in his heart. From that time forth, inflamed by this desire, he sought ever more eagerly how he should destroy Fëanor and end the friendship of the Valar and the elves. But he dissembled his purposes with cunning, and nothing of his malice could yet be seen in the semblance that he wore. Melkor wants to possess the jewels in such a way that prevents others from possessing them. This is Melkor's chief flaw from before the foundations of Arda. For him, love means possession and domination, the need to hoard and to guard a treasure as one's own. In fact, in Ainul Lindale, we learn that Melkor seeks to increase his own power and glory when he is already the most powerful and glorious of created beings. It seems that his own greatness leaves him jealous of the potential of others, with a need to see others always as a threat to his own glory. Thus, he must possess the Silmarils, lest someone else do the same instead of him. In truth, however, Melkor is not the only one to have such a possessive reaction to the Silmarils. Of Fëanor, Tolkien says that he began to love the Silmarils with a greedy love, and grudged the sight of them to all save to his father and his seven sons. He seldom remembered now that the light within them was not his own. Thus Fëanor is slowly corrupted by an illicit desire of possession. The light of the Silmarils, taken as it is from the two trees, is a light belonging to no individual or group of individuals, but common to all. It is quite literally a light that fills the world. When Fëanor creates the Silmarils, he captures and contains something previously free to all. Though Melkor is the first to explicitly desire the Silmarils for his own, Fëanor and others soon follow suit. Thus, Fëanor's love for the light of the two trees poisons the light by containing it, by making it scarce, when all along it is something that should not be contained. His desire and action to possess the blessed light sets into the hearts of the story's free agents the will to possess it, singularly and selfishly. Ungoliant is an enigma and no easy read. Whereas from the beginning of the mythology, Melkor is a vainglorious figure obsessed with domination, Ungoliant, on the other hand, is a mysterious figure of unknown origin, once corrupted to darkness by the seductions of Melkor, but having since repudiated his service for her independence. Yet despite her independence from Melkor, she hates the peoples of Valinor all the same. As Tolkien puts it, she is a figure desiring to be mistress of her own lust, taking all things to herself to feed her emptiness. Still, Melkor knows her deepest need, a desire to be filled by all things. He finds her in the dark caves to the south of Valinor, desperately hungry for the light of the two trees, but hating it all the same, fearful of it and of the Valar who tend it. When he promises her fullness of the light, she sets forth to do his bidding. Melkor wounds the trees, and their sap poured forth as it were their blood, and was spilled upon the ground, presenting Ungoliant with her feast. She sucks up every last drop of the tree's light blood, bloating to a prodigious size, yet famished evermore. Ungoliant's love is turned inward, seeking always fullness, but unable to find it. Acting alone, she is a poison to herself only. Under the influence of another, she is a poison to many. Ungoliant is a nightmare, a hellish vision of self-absorption worthy of Dante. For all that she devours, for all that she poisons, for all that she ruins, she is absorbed by her own hunger and need, at once desiring light but hating it all the same. Tolkien gives us little to go off of with regard to Ungoliant. We do not really know how she took this form, from what estate she fell, only that she was likely corrupted at some time past by Melkor. The same is true of her fate. All we know is that she forsakes Melkor again, and that some have said that she ended when in her uttermost famine she devoured herself at last. In Dante's terms, if Melkor belongs among the wrathful, then Ungoliant has been fixed into the permanent state of the gluttonous, who love sensual pleasure yet hate it all the same. The destruction of the trees causes the Valar to turn their minds to the Silmarils in the hope that their light might be used to heal and restore the trees before it is too late. Yet Feanor laments. Should he surrender the light of the Silmarils themselves would cease to be. It may be that I can unlock my jewels, but never again shall I make their like. And if I must break them, I shall break my heart, and I shall be slain. First of all the Eldar and Aman. In the same instant, the poisonous whisperings of Melkor returned to him, saying that the Silmarils were not safe if the Valar would possess them. And Feanor refuses outright to hand over the Silmarils. Yet before even more controversy can come of the Silmarils, Melkor and Ungoliant steal them from the vault of Formenos, murdering Feanor's father, the Noldor King Finwë, in the process. Melkor, renamed Morgoth, the Black Foe of the World by Feanor and referred to by this name henceforth, flees with the Silmarils and escapes across the Great Sea to his dungeon palace, Angband. Melkor has accomplished all that he designed. He has pitted the elves against the Valar and obtained the Silmarils for his own possession. His victory is complete and leaves Valinor, the once blessed realm, in confusion, darkness, and filth. Having accomplished Melkor's aims, it does not take long for the criminal partners to turn on one another. Ungoliant desires to devour the Silmarils, yet Melkor wants to possess them. Though Ungoliant briefly overpowers Melkor, his minions, the Balrogs, hear his anguished cries and emerge from Angband's depths to deliver their master. At this, Ungoliant flees, not only from the story, but also from history itself. The last we learn of her is that she is the mother of those giant spiders that will come to inhabit both Mirkwood and the pass of Cirith Ungol, Shelob herself. Melkor and Ungoliant are something like the antithesis of the two trees. Whereas the two trees provide light and waters to nourish the hallowed things of Valinor, Melkor and Ungoliant bring darkness and filth with a choking heaviness. It is not simply that they shut out the lights. They bring a substance all their own, with the power to strangle the will. When one considers the impressionistic description of Shelob's lair, that it was a place where night always had been, and always would be, and night was all, one can know better what the darkness of Melkor and Ungoliant really was. Feanor's response to the death of his father and the loss of the Silmarils leads to the third discatastrophe. Setting himself finally against the Valar, he summons the Noldor, elves of his own kin, to continue the pursuit of Morgoth across the Great Sea. He calls them to a vow that will haunt them for the rest of their days. They swore an oath which none shall break and none should take, by the name even of Iluvatar, calling the everlasting dark upon them if they kept it not. And Manwë they named in witness, and Varda, and the hallowed mountain of Tanaquetil, vowing to pursue with vengeance and hatred to the ends of the world Vala, demon, elf, or man as yet unborn, or any creature great or small, good or evil, that time should bring forth into the end of days, whoso should hold or take or keep a Silmaril from their possession. Though Feanor indeed hates Melkor as much as, perhaps more than, any other figure, he is also quite like him. Feanor often seems overly concerned with his own status and protective of his glory. At one point previous, he threatens his younger half-brother Fingolfin in the sight of many, accusing him of seeking to usurp his rightful status as heir to the throne of their father Finwë. One can see this same spirit of jealousy and possession in the words of the oath. Though Feanor is the greatest of all the children of Ilúvatar in talent, he is ever weary of his status, much like Melkor, and therefore must guard it jealously, and if need be, bring destruction to those who would stand in the way of his aims. Great ill comes of the oath, for it leads to a standoff between the army of Feanor and their elvish brethren, the Teleri, who refuse to grant them use of their ships in crossing the Great Sea to pursue Morgoth. A battle is joined in which many of each side perish, an event ever after known as the Kinslaying. Yet Feanor and his brethren finally obtain many ships and undertake their voyage of pursuit across the Great Sea. What follows is a long story of great sorrow, of the lamentable outcomes of Feanor's oath. One begins to detect in the examples of Melkor, Feanor, and even Ungoliant, the attitudes of the spirit that are seen in later figures. The keenest example of this is Gollum. Gollum must possess Sauron's ring. In one way, his need to possess it reflects Melkor's own jealous attitude. For another to possess the ring is unacceptable and means that he will not be able to possess it. In another way, he is like Ungoliant, not really possessing so much as being possessed by it to his utter end and destruction. No matter what the object of lust and jealousy is, sacred jewels, ring of power, Arkenstone, the need to possess, to have the object of love, results in a disorder that leads to catastrophe and tragedy. We will also come to see that Melkor is like the dragons of later years, seeking to possess to no truly profitable end. To possess the Silmarils is to deprive others of their life-giving light, much like, for Smaug, to possess the Lonely Mountain is to deprive the dwarves of their kingdom and their treasure. Possession for them is about both personal glory and depriving others. Indeed, Melkor retreats into Angband only to emerge once again, content like Smaug to simply hoard his treasure to himself. And like all those who possess Sauron's ring, Melkor comes to find that his prized possessions are a great weariness to him, though he would never part from them. Indeed, evil is a wearying and heavy thing, though not easily broken with. Though Melkor, unlike Ungoliant, had a motive for obtaining the Silmarils that went beyond mere possession, now that he has them in his revenge upon the Valar, he becomes increasingly Ungoliant-like, becoming inwardly focused, seeking only to cast further darkness. His will is slowly diminishing, and his life force passing away, though as the greatest of Ilúvatar's creations, he has plenty to spare. I hope you enjoyed the first two chapters of Tolkien's Requiem. Make sure to visit tolkiensrequiem.com for more info on how to get the whole thing in audiobook, paperback, or ebook. Don't forget, signed copies are available and make great gifts for yourself or the other Tolkien fanatics in your life. Thanks for listening, and until next time, the road goes ever on.